disbelief. Okay. So the point is that these things do not objectively exist. An orc does not objectively exist. And yet somehow it tells us something about the nature of life or what happens when we, I don't know, have an argument with a lawnmower. So the suspension of disbelief happens within the sort of parameters of a very particular question, which is, what if this were actually true? What if this story were actually true? And I think this question is actually the question that leads a lot of people to faith in Christ, which is, what happens if this story is actually true? Maybe it's not just something someone made up. Maybe it's a real thing. Okay, and so we, in this sort of suspension of disbelief, we discover that maybe our original beliefs weren't such great beliefs in the first place. Maybe. But what I want to point out, and it's not often noticed, is that we don't suspend disbelief around everything or about everything. There are things in the story that we have to still be there for us to actually accept the reality of the story. Things like the nature of friendship, the nature of evil. We have to accept that certain parameters still hold to be true. And what I would say is the suspension of disbelief actually points to us, or points out to us, what we actually believe. And I think that's why it's particularly helpful. I want to use an example from G.K. Chesterton, who says this: "There is the chivalrous lesson of Jack the Giant Killer that giants should be killed because they are gigantic. It is a manly mutiny against pride as such." Okay, I hit the pause button. So we don't believe that giants of the kind that exist in Jack and the Beanstalk are kind of realities, right? But we accept that there are giants, prideful people that need to be done away with. We've all heard of Hitler. We've all heard of Stalin. Other examples, Sauron is kind of, you know, the Lord of the Rings example. But what I would also want to say is that the monstrosity that we see in these fictional characters is also something that we encounter within ourselves. And so this is actually something that all of these, you know, the orcs, that, I mean, we all know, the enemy is within. The orcs are not just out there. They talk to us about some kind of condition of our own reality. And so that's something that we learn from Lord of the Rings or Jack and the Beanstalk. To continue what Chesterton says, "There is the lesson of Cinderella, which is the same as that of the Magnificat. Exaltavit humiles, which is God exalts the humble." Have you noticed that in every story that you love, the underdog is the one you want to win? My wife and I the other day watched Spider-Man. Spider-Man is a geeky kid with no sort of, he doesn't have much charm, and he becomes a geeky kid with superpowers. But through this sort of process, he overcomes some of his inward struggles. And we naturally love stories about underdogs. When you have sort of prideful characters, at the start of something, that's called a tragedy. Shakespeare was really good at working with this sort of thing. So that's just, I think, a crucial idea that we learn from something like Cinderella. "There is a great lesson," as Chesterton continues, "of Beauty and the Beast, that a thing must be loved before it is lovable." Anyone who's a parent of a two-year-old will know this. "There is the terrible allegory of the Sleeping Beauty, which tells how the human creature was blessed with all birthday gifts, yet cursed with death, and how death may also perhaps be softened to a sleep." So in the light of this, what I would suggest is that faith precedes facts, but it is not opposed to reason. Okay, faith precedes facts, but it's not opposed to reason. Even science is rooted in premises of faith. First one, that there is an ordered world outside of our minds. That's something you can't prove. It's something you have to accept first before you can deal with it. You also can't prove that your mind has the ability to know this order. It's something you have to accept on faith. So the fact that you can do scientific experiments is rooted in those two premises of faith. The third one is that we can trust those from whom we are learning regarding the nature of this order. Trust, so for example, in academia, you trust the people that have come before you. Sometimes not too much, but you do. I mean, there's a certain level of trust that comes in there. Trust is a transcendent act. It's not something that you have necessarily got concrete proof for. So faith is actually just like at the heart of every form of engagement with reality. So theists, atheists, agnostics all live by faith. How many of you checked that your chair would hold you before you sat down? That's faith. You have a certain amount of experience that teaches you that this is how reality works, that chairs should hold bottoms. But you actually sat down, most of you, without checking. Okay, that is what faith is like. I think it's a good analogy. So faith is not opposed to facts. It's not opposed to facts. So I want to stress that. But it simply tries to find a home for facts. It's something that some people get a little uneasy with, but I think it's worth pointing out that the Bible itself is filled with fiction. I'm not saying that the Bible is fiction. I'm saying that it is filled with fiction. Example, Jesus told parables. We learn in Matthew 13 that he told parables at every point that he could. So his primary pedagogical method was through fiction, right? And he would have been fine with this because fiction was part of the tradition that he grew up in. Some scholars suggest that there are other books in the scriptures that are also fiction. Two sort of obvious examples are the book of Job and the book of Jonah. Some people might be disturbed by that, but I think that comes from a sort of modernist bias that says that fiction is not as good as fact. And I'm saying, well, maybe fiction points to truth in a different way to facts do. A third example would be the things like visions in the scriptures, like Ezekiel's vision or John's one recorded in the book of Revelation. Those are not objective facts, right? But, I mean, dry bones dancing, that kind of thing, Ezekiel, very fun. A fun night out. That's a really interesting vision. It didn't objectively happen, and yet I think what it taps into is that there is deep, deep truth about what the nature of life, the nature of death and rebirth, the nature of death and resurrection. So I think that's something that needs to be pointed out. So my point here is truth and facts are not the same thing, and Tolkien's stories are not necessarily factual. We all know this, but I think that they are deeply, deeply and profoundly true. So, I mean, I find more truth in Lord of the Rings than I do in our newspapers, for example. Our newspapers are filled with facts and devoid of truth. There's this kind of, everyone thinks that once you understand the facts, that's when you understand the reality. It's not true. I think we need some kind of contextual framework that helps us to navigate the facts, and that's what I think faith is. So the next point that I want to bring up is that this idea that faith itself is the proof. It's a fairly unusual idea, but I want to start just by pointing out that fairy tales present us with very, very reasonable worlds. In a fairy tale, Lord of the Rings, we've got hobbits, and they are always smaller than men. Always. At no point does it become completely illogical and the hobbits suddenly grow 50 feet. Because their nature is to be small, right? So that's a reasonable thing. There are logical consequences that still happen within this fairy tale world. And so that's the kind of world that a fairy tale presents us with, and yet in fairy tales there is always mystery, and I think that is what faith is. It's a mystery. The more you try and explain it, it's almost like the further away you get from fully understanding it. So it's this really mysterious force. I have a number of very reasonable reasons for believing in the truth of Christianity, but ultimately I have to say there's probably something that I can't explain. So just to sort of back me up, it's always helpful to have a backup philosopher. This is Kierkegaard, and he says, there is only one ultimate proof for the truth of Christianity, the inward proof. Argumentum spiritus sancti. If you want to sound clever, just throw Latin into what you've done. Which is the argument of the Holy Spirit. The Apostle John intimates this. If we receive the testimony of men, that is all the historical proofs and considerations, the testimony of God is greater. That is, the inward testimony is greater. And then, John writes, he who believes in the Son of God has the testimony in himself. It is not reasons that justify faith in God's Son, but just the opposite. Faith in God's Son is the testimony. Faith is the movement of infinity within itself. That is a good line. Faith is the movement of infinity within itself. And what I love about it is it's almost incomprehensible. So if you're feeling that, it's true. Okay. And it cannot be otherwise. It is mysterious. Everything previous is preparatory, preliminary, something which disappears as soon as the conviction arrives. Faith itself is the testimony. I think what Kierkegaard is doing is pointing out something very, very true. People will only accept what they already believe. People only accept what they already believe. It's a strange thing. I've taught for quite a number of years now. And this kind of, as soon as I present a new theory to my students, but it's counterintuitive, they can't accept it. No matter how true it is, it's just impossible to accept. Because somehow our knowledge requires faith to precede it. Kierkegaard also writes that faith is not tested by reasons, but by life. I think that's very true. It's not just about our intellectual capacity to understand. Somehow faith must be true for every single aspect of life. Our emotional well-being, our physicality. I think that's something that faith must speak to our whole existence. And I think this is what fairy tales point to. That truth is something that we encounter at multiple levels of our existence. It's not just found at the level of our own sort of factual materiality. Okay, so that's something that I find to be crucial. This points to my next point, and by now I've lost count of which point this is. Faith means participation, not merely intellectual assent. So faith requires some form of actual activity and not merely some form of agreement or intellectual agreement. What I'm going to ask Herman to do is just play a clip from the first Lord of the Rings movie. This is the Council of Elrond. In the book, it is one of the most boring chapters written. It is, but I found it. My opinion there. But what's interesting about this is you've got all the races of Middle Earth. So for those of you who are clueless in Lord of the Rings land, don't panic. I will try and help somehow. There are all the races of Middle Earth are gathering in Rivendell, which is the elf city, one of the elf cities. Okay, and they gather there to decide what to do with what is called the One Ring of Power. Okay, this one ring happened to fall into the hands of a hobbit. Hobbits are completely innocent and largely clueless. And one of the hobbits brought this ring to Rivendell so that they could decide what to do. Why? Because this ring basically meant that evil would persist. That's probably the worst explanation I could have given. But hopefully you'll see this. What you should get is that the ring is very serious. It's a very important thing that they have to destroy it, but they don't exactly know how to do it. So that's what the clip hopefully will explain.
Strangers from distant lands, friends of old, you've been summoned here to answer the threat of Mordor. Middle-earth stands upon the brink of destruction. None can escape it. You will unite or you will fall. Each race is bound to this fate, this one doom. Bring forth the ring, Frodo.
Thank you. gift to the foes of Mordor. Why not use this ring? Long has my father, the steward of Gondor, kept the forces of Mordor at bay. By the blood of our people are your lands kept safe. Give Gondor the weapon of the enemy. Let us use it against him.
You cannot wield it. None of us can. The One Ring answers to Sauron alone. It has no other master.
And what would a ranger know of this matter? This is no mere ranger. He is Aragorn, son of Arathorn. You owe him your allegiance. Aragorn. This is Isildur's heir. And heir to the throne of Gondor.
Have a bad deal, Lewis.
Gondor has no king. Gondor needs no king.
Aragorn is right. We cannot use it.
You have only one choice. The ring must be destroyed.
And what are we waiting for?
The ring cannot be destroyed, Gimli, son of Glóin, by any craft that we here possess. The ring was made in the fires of Mount Doom. Only there can it be unmade. It must be taken deep into Mordor and cast back into the fiery chasm from whence it came. One of you must do this.
One does not simply walk into Mordor. Its black gates are guarded by more than just orcs. There is evil there that does not sleep. And the great eye is ever watchful. It is a barren wasteland, riddled with fire and ash and dust. The very air you breathe is a poisonous fume. Not with 10,000 men could you do this. It is folly.
Have you heard nothing Lord Elrond has said? The ring must be destroyed.
And I suppose you think you're the one to do it.
And if we fail, what then? What happens when Sauron takes back what is his?
I will be dead before I see the ring in the hands of an elf. So much more. No one trusts an elf. Do you not understand?
I will take the ring to Mordor. No. I do not know the way.
I will.
Okay, so just imagine that the older races of Middle-earth are basically a bunch of theologians. And what they're doing is they're arguing about all sorts of doctrinal issues, right? Because, I mean, some people didn't, somehow they got the sort of levels of justification wrong or some form of atonement theory, like, wrong, and they're all at each other's throats. And Frodo, I think, demonstrates what I think is truly faith. He basically says that he will take this. He will actually do the thing that needs to be done. Forget about all these arguments about who is better and who is worse and who has more degrees or all of these things. It's simply about taking the job at hand and doing it. It's so there's a level of participation there. One of the things that I would stress is kind of crucial to Christianity is this idea that we don't believe that a number of things are true. We believe in Jesus. It's belief in a person. And I think one of the things that I've noticed, you know, just in the media, there are all sorts of these conflicts around theology especially. And I think, you know, to some extent those miss the point. Because I think they reflect that basically there's a lot of anxiety that develops when our belief becomes centered on doctrines and dogmas and creeds. It's because those things, now suddenly if that's where your belief is, you suddenly have to get them absolutely right. You have to be absolutely sure that your doctrine is the exact right doctrine. Instead of, well, maybe we should just look at Jesus and what he stood for. I had a fantastic conversation with one of my students last week. The student is an atheist, and very outspokenly so. And I said to him, well, you know what, I think that it's possible for atheists to be Christians. I know that, and from some of your frowns, that was hit the right note. He can't believe in God, like in the idea that there is a transcendent being who is somewhere out there. But when I asked this student, what do you think of Jesus? What do you think of this guy who basically looked out for the poor, who lived a life of love, who was courageous? What do you think about that? And he said, well, I kind of like that. Follow him. That's what Jesus said. Like you just need to follow him. Like whether you get all your doctrinal ducks in a row may not be, hypothetically, the most important thing to do. I've discovered that when you put your faith in Jesus instead of in stuff, and believe me, I'm an intellectual, my 24/7 way of thinking is to get all the doctrinal ducks in a row. But it's a bit like wine tasting, isn't it? When you taste wine or go to a wine tasting event, you're going to find out all sorts of different intricate details around whether one wine is fruitier or oakier or nuttier. But you don't go to a wine tasting event if you're thirsty. And I think that's why Jesus talks about himself in terms of these metaphors. He's bread. I mean, you can go doctrinally nuts around that. Like, what kind of bread? Is it Soylent loaf from Woolworths? And Jesus' response is, look, he's the bread. Look, if you're hungry, you know what that means. That's what he's talking about. And I think that's something that fairy tales tell us in terms of, like, the job of the prince is to go and save the princess. He's not going to spend hours arguing around, like, which kind of horse is the best horse. It's not really the point, is it? So I think that's kind of a helpful point. Abraham Heschel, again, he says this, the danger of dogmas lies in their tendency to serve as vicarious faith. As if all we had to do were to accept on authority a fixed set of principles or propositions without the necessity of searching for a way of faith, a way of faith. But dogmas, if they are to serve a purpose at all, should be a summary of faith rather than a substitute for faith. So this is an idea that I'm very intrigued by, because I think to some extent what we do is, I think most of us who start out with some kind of a Christian walk have this experience, an event that shapes our relationship with reality. And then what we do is we go and we add words to explain the experience. And those words are very helpful, and I mean what I'm doing here is giving you a bunch of words, but the words are helpful until they become the point. Suddenly the event gets sidetracked. The building of the church is great if it's going to house people. If it's actually going to provide a space for people to have encounters with what it means to live in a community, for example. Part of community life is to suffer with each other. And sometimes that has double meaning. Sometimes it's suffering from being with each other. And, you know, so you get that idea. And I think that's kind of a crucial thing. Sometimes we also let churches believe on our behalf. That's another form of vicarious faith. To some extent, the pastor must always have strong faith so that you don't have to believe yourself. You can just trust him to believe on your behalf. So you don't need to act as long as someone else is going out and loving the poor and doing those kinds of things. And I think on some level, this vicarious faith has become almost natural in our society. This idea of believing, not really believing. An example, I mean, I think of that great theological text, Kung Fu Panda, where at the start of Kung Fu Panda, you've got like this whole basic mockery, Buddhism, don't believe it, and then you've got like Kung Fu, but don't believe it. It's there, it's fun, it's something to mock. But then at the end of the film, what's the point? You have to believe. Don't ridicule this, it's actually serious. But there's this, the whole tone of the film is actually one of mockery. And I think the same sort of thing happens with this idea of vicarious faith. Something believes on our behalf. But a fairy tale points us to this idea that participation is crucial. Or a fictional story like the story of the Good Samaritan. Who is the best believer in that scenario with, you know, you've got your priest, your scribe, Pharisee, you've got all of these believers, but the one who believes the most deeply is basically the one who didn't get his doctrinal ducks into a row. Okay, so this points me to my next idea, which is faith made visible is love. Faith made visible is love. So if you want to know where faith is, look at the fruit, basically, the way that people are loved. I want to point out, somewhere along the line, the word belief in English got confused with a kind of epistemological condition. It was something to do with knowledge. You believe that certain things are true, right? But the word belief comes from the exact same root word as the Afrikaans word liefde. And you can see, I mean, the spelling is even there. Originally, and I think this is closer to the biblical understanding of what belief is, to believe means to live by love. That is what faith is. And of course, this means an opportunity to read from another philosopher, Simon Critchley. He says this, faith is an enactment. So you can see this action idea. It's an enactment in relation to a calling. Faith announces itself in a situation of crisis where a decisive intervention is called for. In other words, faith takes place in a situation of struggle. It is not an empty, fixed, or constant state with the distant payoff of final bliss in the afterlife. It is, rather, an enactment in the present that is shot through both by the facticity of the past, for Paul that's the fact of the resurrection, and the imminence of the future. Faith is a word whose force consists in the event of its proclamation. The proclamation of faith is a betrothal where one affiances, like promises oneself to another. This recalls the famous line of thinking from 1 Corinthians 13, where Paul insists that if faith is not underwritten by love, then, and he says, I am a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. If faith is a troth plight that proclaims the calling of the infinite demand, the infinite demand in Critchley's language is this infinite desire to serve and love each other, then the proclamation has to be supported by love, which bears all things, believes all things, hopes all things, endures all things. Faith without love is a hollow clanging that lacks the subjective commitment to endure. So just having an idea, an intellectual idea of what faith is not going to sustain you. It's not going to be enough, basically. As Paul puts it in Galatians, for in Christ Jesus neither circumcision nor uncircumcision is of any avail, but faith working through love. Simon Critchley is an atheist, and he gets it. And I think that's something that I find really profound. He goes, where will I look? Because it's interesting to track his thought. He's been looking at what philosophy is. And basically, his question for all of these years has been how to live. And this question of how to live naturally led him to the question, how to love. And the best examples he can find of what love really is in the Christian scriptures. And I think that's certainly an example that we should emulate. Love is deeply connected to giving up power. And so my point here is that faith is non-power. Faith is giving up power. The Lord of the Rings centers on this idea of this one ring of power that needs to be destroyed. This is not an idea that is necessarily very popular in our culture, because our culture is centered around meritocracy. Your value somehow gets tied up in how well you do. So the idea, you know, your kids go to school and it's, if they don't do so well, there's like pandemonium, because now suddenly they're going to not be as valued in society. It's a sick society that actually determines our value by how well we achieve. And to some extent, I think even the Christian media perpetuates this. An example, some of the kind of Christian books that I've seen in Kum Bookshop, for example, which I try and visit as infrequently as possible. But there's this idea that those bookshops present a kind of infomercial Christianity. You know, infomercials, they start with someone like, usually a poor housewife whose life is over because her vacuum cleaner doesn't work. And they film her, always in black and white, so it makes her life look dull. And you see her kids are like treating her badly and her husband disrespects her. Her whole life is falling apart. But she gets the vacuum cleaner, this new fantastic vacuum cleaner that can vacuum clean up walls and I don't know what else. And now suddenly, everything is fine. Her family life is good. Her relationships are fixed. And to some extent, I've gotten the feeling that Christianity can be presented as like the cure, right? Your life will be fine. What did Jesus do? He called his disciples and he said, come, follow me. I will give you a life that is 100% pure fulfillment. And one of them ends up committing suicide. 11 of them, 10 of them get martyred. An additional one gets exiled. Did they lead a fulfilled life? Yeah. I think absolutely. They probably would have a lot to say about the kind of lives we lead. Although I think in South Africa we do have a sort of sense of genuine terror most days. We step outside the house and panic because it's terrifying. But I think this is something that Jesus says, you know what, your life will not necessarily be easy. And I think that's something that Lord of the Rings particularly does well. It says, look, if you want to do something that is of genuine value, it's not going to be easy. There's going to be struggle, there's going to be pain, you're going to lose people you care about. There's this kind of almost, I think you can take this too far and generate this kind of heretical Christianity that demands that you should be persecuted all the time, otherwise your faith is not good enough. I don't think that's where it should go. I think this idea that sometimes there just is this consequence of living your faith will lead you to struggle. Faith is not the thing that allows you to achieve greater things. It's the thing that teaches you how to die. Die to self, death to your own sort of control, sense of control. I actually think that faith and control are incompatible. I think the illusion that we get given in our culture is one of you can control your life. If something goes wrong, insurance. If something goes wrong in sort of your health, you get medical aid of some kind. And I think those things are good. I'm not going to diss them, but I think it's really good to notice that those things present a particular kind of message, which is that everything is going to be fine if you're in charge. And I think, I mean, like, it just doesn't work that way. When Frodo goes to Mount Doom, I mean, that's the mission. The mission is he has to take this ring to Mount Doom, chuck it in, let it disintegrate so that evil, at least that sort of kind of evil, will be destroyed. Frodo, throughout the journey, goes, I don't think we're going to make it back. I think this is actually going to kill me. I think we're not going to see our friends again. There's this genuine sense of the kind of struggle of what it means to do something that is worthwhile, which is a kind of doom and gloomy message. Thought that's what you probably wanted to hear. But there is another side of this, which is faith means looking to your front. Looking to your front. What I mean by this, I will explain by the use of some images. Okay, so the first image is these are palantirs, pronounced differently depending on how Elvish literate you are. So the palantirs are these seeing stones. For an idea, this is like the Skype of the fairy tale world. Okay, so it allows you to communicate across great distances, and through this communication you can actually see what's going on at long distance. Okay, so there are seven seeing stones, three of them we know where they are, four of them are unaccounted for, and three times in the Lord of the Rings movies and books they are made use of. Okay, the first time is this time, which is that Saruman, through the seeing stone, sees Sauron. Sauron is the big baddie, the guy who made the One Ring, etc. And Saruman sees Sauron, and it's very easy to get those two confused, right? But anyway, don't worry about that. And in that seeing of Sauron, Saruman thinks, wow, Sauron is doing really well. I think I can use this as an opportunity to build up my own strength. Okay? Saruman was, you know, misled basically by this ancient fairyland Skype. Okay, the second time we see, and this is just an image of Pippin holding this seeing stone. In this, Sauron sees Pippin and he thinks, oh wait, Saruman has Pippin. He didn't, but he was misled. Okay, Saruman has Pippin, which means that Saruman must have the One Ring because the Hobbit has the ring. I can't even keep up with myself, so I'm glad you're struggling too. But okay, so second time. The third time, Sauron gets, Sauron sees Aragorn in the palantir. And through this, Sauron thinks, oh my goodness, Aragorn must have the ring. So it's basically like Piggy in the Middle, but in fairyland style, okay? And on big epic battle style, okay? So he sees this. And as a result, Sauron sends his troops out. And as Tolkien says in the book, the hasty stroke oft goes astray. He acts too quickly as a result of this. And then the fourth time, we see Denethor, who's one of the most depressed-looking people I've ever seen in my life. He is bitter because he used the palantir, saw Sauron in the palantir, and thought Sauron must actually have the ring, which means all hope is gone. All the while, the people that have the ring are Sam and Frodo. Okay? And they are nowhere near this fancy Skype machine. Okay. So they actually, it's safe. But this is actually, I think, a very unique idea in the book. It's this idea how seeing over great distances can actually distort our understanding. And I think this is so, so relevant to our current context. Because we're constantly watching the news and we're going, it's time to freak out. Because obviously everything is going badly. You know what the news is? It's a bunch of journalists digging through the trash. Because what is a household? It's something that runs really well, generally, okay, with the odd chaos in between. But it runs pretty well. But you take the trash that's in the house, you put it into the trash can and put it outside. And then the garbage removal people come along and they take the trash away. Everything is going fine, more or less. But the trash is still gonna happen. The garbage removal people are the journalists. Okay? If you're a journalist, please come and chat to me. I think you can change the world. But I think a truly shocking headline would be something like, 40,000 people are actually fine. They're fine. Nothing happened that was particularly extraordinary. Wouldn't it be an interesting way of looking at the world? I think it might change the way that we... But what Tolkien, I think, gets at with this whole palantir metaphor is there's an infantry slogan, and Tolkien would have been familiar with this because he went through the First World War. The infantry slogan was this: look to your front. Keep looking ahead. As soon as you're more worried about what's happening around you, you lose focus on what you're supposed to be doing, and you end up screwing it up. Okay, so it's really important. Just keep doing what you're doing. The most unhappy people I know are the people who spend all their time worrying about where other people are at. Who cares? I think comparison breeds contempt. If we compare ourselves to others, I mean, there's that passage at the end of the book of John where one of the disciples says to Jesus, "What's happening with this guy?" And Jesus says, "What's that to you? You should do your job, not worry about that guy's job." I think that's what faith is. Faith is knowing this is my job. It's not something that we see in films. We have cross-cutting, so we constantly cutting between Frodo and Sam and Aragorn and all the rest. And so you figure out what everyone is doing. But they don't have any idea what's happening with each other. They have no connection. They have no idea whether they even stand a chance of winning. But what do? They keep plodding on. So I think that's something that it was a bit of an epiphany for me, that faith means just looking to the front. If we don't do this, if we get distracted, we often find ourselves despairing. Despair is really a form of control because it says, "I refuse to accept that things will be okay." That's what despair is. It's not going to be okay. It's always been rubbish. So why should it ever? That's still you in the driver's seat. That's the kind of understanding of despair. And what I've discovered is that the opposite of faith is not doubt, but despair. Doubt is fine. I think it sometimes terrifies people, but doubt is really not anti-God at all. I'm full of doubts. But it doesn't seem to affect my faith that much. I think what affects faith is anxiety and despair. So one of the things, just the last point that I think is very helpful in just understanding what faith is about being convicted of things that you're hoping for. Some things that are not, you know, necessarily absolutely certain. But this hope, and I think this is what fairy tales take very, very seriously, the hope is that things will be okay. In the end, somehow, mysteriously, our desire, our deepest human longing is for things to be okay. Even the most hardened cynic, and I've met a few. I've been a hardened cynic at least once in a few days, whatever. But the idea is like the most hardened cynic is still the person who hopes for joy, happiness, a good cup of coffee. Okay, these simple ideas are actually built into our humanity. Our humanity is that aspect of us that desires good. And I think this is what fairy tales point to. Tolkien had this word, he called it the eucatastrophe. Eucatastrophe. So catastrophe means bad. Eu is the same word we use in eulogy, good word. So this idea of a good turning point. The point at which something happens where suddenly the light shines in and you go, oh, maybe it's not so bad. It's something that I always I like pointing out. Your ability to see that things are wrong comes from a good place. Make sense? So even when things are going completely horribly wrong, the fact that you notice that is because of this inward desire for things to be okay. And so I think this is what fairy tales take very seriously, our desire for all things to turn out well. And that's why they all end with that. Sometimes we don't want to believe it, but I think our desire tells us that we want things to end well, to end with us saying, happily ever after. So that is it for me, all this bombardment of ideas. And now is the moment to discuss and dialogue around these ideas.